it was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking. And I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker has established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Beringer, I buy Cabernets, so should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome as we celebrate our 100th podcast.
It's a fact that many wine drinkers love learning more about what it takes to make wine. Perhaps even many of our listeners have made their own wine. Either way, other than the fact that it takes a lot of beer to make great wine, it also takes a great deal of knowledge. For our 100th podcast, we present Words of the Winemakers. Well, you can't really swing an empty wine bottle without hitting a wine glossary on the web. We wanted to record the real thing. In this podcast, we feature 21 winemakers from California, Italy, Oregon, and Wisconsin, giving you their definition of words used on a daily basis in making wine. We hope you enjoy this intimate look into the winemaker's world. And a very special thanks to these winemakers that gave us their own point of view. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Sarah Fowler, winemaker here at Peju Winery. My wine word is clone. So I have a quick, easy explanation on what the word clone means to the wine industry, or what it is just in general. So a clone, there's all these different varietals, and we're talking wine specific. So there's Merlot, and there's Cabernet Sauvignon, there's Syrah, Chardonnay. But in each one of these varietals, there's what we call a clone. So what that means is, and I'll use an example, is Cabernet Sauvignon. There will be multiple different types of Cabernet Sauvignon. And with that said, a simple explanation would be Labrador Retriever. Labrador Retriever would be the varietal. The clone would be Chocolate Lab, Blonde Lab, Black Lab, even a Labradoodle. So to me, that's kind of an easy explanation on how to explain the word clone.
My name's Buck Bartolucci. I'm a member of the Bartolucci family. Our family owns Madonna Estate Winery in the southern end of the Napa Valley in the Carneros District. My word is propagation when it pertains to grapevines. Because in California, we have a pest called phylloxera. It requires that we plant our grapevines on resistant rootstock, that being rootstock that's resistant to the bug phylloxera. But that rootstock never has any fruit. So in order for us to end up with a given crop of, let's say, Pinot Noir or Chardonnay, we have to either bud or graft onto that rootstock the variety we want. In our case, we use a technique called field budding, where we plant the rootstock in the spring of the year, and in the fall, we come in and we take a little piece, a chip, of the grape variety we want, let's say Pinot Noir, and we make an incision into that rootstock and insert that chip into the rootstock and tie it with a rubber band. That sits over the winter, it knits into the plant. The following spring, we come and remove the head of the grapevine, forcing that bud that's knitted in there to grow. Thus, we end up with that variety that we want.
Hello, I am Vincenzo Ippolito from Ippolito 1845 Winery. from Calabria, southern of Italy, and my wine is made with the Gallioppo grapes. Gallioppo is a very unique grape, which gives you very exclusive wine experience. It's very complex on the nose, from fruity to spicy notes, with a very good taste. It's very intense and persistent. It's a full-bodied wine, and I suggest you to drink it with tasty food, like steak, sausage, or some tasty pasta from our region, and just enjoy that together.
I'm Doug Schaefer, and the word of the day is green thinning. Green thinning is the whole concept of thinning off, thinning out, pulling off underripe fruit out of a vineyard before harvest. It's usually right around veraison, another term, which is when grapes change color, if they're red grapes, or if they're white grapes, kind of go from being hard to softer, if you will. But with red grapes especially, it's very easy to walk through a vineyard halfway through veraison. Veraison might last a week, 10 days, and you can go through, and as a vineyard is almost 80% turn color, you can go through and see a cluster that's still green berries. That cluster is definitely less ripe than the majority of the clusters. So if you don't do anything, that green cluster, those green berries, will turn black, but at harvest time, they're going to be much less ripe. They'll be quite underripe compared to the primary crop. But the guys picking won't know that. They'll say that they're black grapes, they're going to pick it. So the idea is at veraison, right when that color change happens, going through the vineyard, identifying these clusters that are way behind, way green compared to already turned color, and snipping them off, thinning the crop off, putting it on the ground, because we don't want that underripe fruit in the tank. You can take green thinning to the next level. You can have a cluster that has half the cluster is pretty green and the rest has turned color. You can actually snip off half that cluster. Then you can take it to the super extreme level, which Elias has talked me into doing for Hillside Select, where you actually go in and you pull off green berries off a cluster. So you're taking berries off of a cluster. Now that's very extreme, and one would only do that usually with, you know, top quality wines, because it's incredibly labor intensive. But just the whole notion of green thinning right at veraison, getting those green clusters off so they don't end up in the tank later.
I'm Tor Kenward of Tor Kenward Family Wines. My word is actually two words, if I'm allowed. It's optimal ripeness. It's used a lot, and what it means is the perfect time to pick a grape. And a perfect time to pick a grape really will depend on where that grape is, where it is in the cluster, where it is on the vine, or on the whether it's a cordon or a cane shoot, and where that is, that vine is in the vineyard. Bump, bump, bump. You can just extend it on out. It's very, very different, you know, 50 feet away from that vine to that vine. It becomes very, very different. So optimum ripeness is the perfect time to pick that grape, that year, that vintage. It's the same thing that you have when you're going to the farmer's market. And toward the end of the season, you go up to the melon guy, and he's got those little samples of melons. And if you've never been to a farmer's market that had the melon guy, I'm sorry for you. Anyway, at that time, he'll give you a bite of melon that will, you'll just go, oh my gosh, this is what melon really is. It isn't what I usually have when I'm traveling at this hotel or that hotel in December. This is that wonderful October melon, because it's sweet, almost to the point where it's painfully sweet, yet it still has fabulous acidity, and it still is crunchy. It has great texture. It hasn't started to fall apart yet. And that is exactly what we're trying to do with wine grapes, and that is optimal ripeness.
My name's Brett Bartolucci, and I'm the fourth generation of Madonna Estate Winery in the Napa Valley. We're located in the Carneros region, the southern end of the valley. And my word today is Brettanomyces. And I picked this word because my first name is Brett, so I get teased a lot because Brettanomyces, the short version of the word, is Brett. And basically what it is, in a short definition, is it's a mildew, or bacteria rather, that can get inside of barrels that can cause off flavors or aromas to the wine, such as a characteristic that might be considered like a barnyard characteristic, or a more, shall we say, manure characteristic. So I often ask my parents, on a side note, why they named me Brett, because I'm in the wine industry.
Kenny Kahn, Blue Rock Vineyard. Terroir, it's a French word that doesn't really have an English translation, but to put it as simply as I can, it is the sum total of everything that makes a vineyard and the resulting wine special. So that would be the soil, the climate, the aspect. I think that the human touch certainly has a lot to do with it. So it's everything that goes into making that site something that is unique and special, that gives you the flavors and aromas that you get off of it.
I'm Jessica Bell from mywineschool.com, and my word today is garagiste. The word garagiste is French, and so it comes from the French region of Bordeaux. It was started there because you had a counterculture to the aristocratic establishment. And a garagiste was someone who found perhaps a small plot of vineyard, took care of the vines, and then created a wine, sometimes in their garage, which is where the word came from, but took great measures to take care of that wine. And as a result, the wine was of high quality, but because of the small production and labor-intensive process, they were also quite expensive. So a garagiste now, these days, tends to be a small production wine that is very much cared for in the winery, and then usually sold at a high price.
I am Brett Delurs with ZD Wines. My word is organic. And organic is a very interesting word. It's something that we have passion about here at ZD Wines. We farm organically and have farmed organically for many years. And I often get the question, what does that mean? And what it means to us is it means paying very close attention to the environment we are in and living in a certain way that we are building rather than destroying the soil, the vines, the environment around us to as great a degree as possible. A lower level or a more simple level means not using petrochemicals. It means using compost. It means building, 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 I think, in the end. So I will leave it at that.
Name's Phil Steinschreiber. I'm the winemaker for Diamond Creek Vineyards and for my own winery as well called Watermark. And today we'll discuss bloom in the vineyards. And bloom is when the vine is pushing its flowers, and just that, it's a bloom. It's a bloom of the flowers. And the vine itself basically fertilizes itself. It best happens when the temperatures are about 75 to 85 degrees, when it's clear days, when it's not raining, because that can eventually lead to shatter. So we get these nice little flowers, and we like to have them set as much fruit as possible. And basically, that's what bloom is.
My name is Lynn Grace from Wiseacre Vineyard. My description of biodynamic, it would be, in a nutshell, harnessing the energy of your particular piece of property, or enhancing that energy, bringing it together, farming with intent. If you are farming biodynamically and organically, if you're farming that way, you're going to produce a better grape because there is so much intention involved and focus, positive energy. You can't be a bad farmer because when you're out there farming biodynamically, you're farming so intimately, so microbially, it's a better product.
Hi, I'm Charlie Meeker. I'm the owner and co-owner with my wife and winemaker at the Meeker Vineyard in Sonoma County, and my word is Appellation. Appellation. Well, Appellation, so it was started, I think, in France. And it defines a particular region. The French did it in the middle 1800s. And it defines a region that's has the wine's characteristic of that region. Sometimes there's multiple wines. And in France, it's very restrictive. You can only use certain grapes within each appellation. I mean, Bordeaux is an appellation. Burgundy is an appellation. Chablis. In the United States, and Italy's adopted that in a broader, but really in the similar, and once again, they restrict grapes. In the United States, like Dry Creek Valley is an appellation within Sonoma County. Russian River Valley is an appellation in Sonoma County. Alexander Valley is an appellation. And they're all defined, you know, by with limits around them, and there's no limit on what grapes you can do from them. We think, for example, that Alexander Valley is particularly great at growing Bordeaux varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, whereas Dry Creek is best known for Zinfandel, Petit Syrah, those style grapes, Syrah to some extent, and the Russian River, which is cooler, is best known for Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and grapes like that. So it's something to pay attention to. Some appellations that are so broad, so large, that you know they cover different. They're not really specific in terms of a different wine region, but it's a good way to think of the wine business.
I'm Michael Scholes. I'm the winemaker with St. Supery Vineyards here in the Napa Valley. And you know, the question at hand is how do we define clone, as in, I guess, clonal selection and what have you that we have in the vineyard. And that's it's a tricky little thing, because while I feel like it's has clarity in my mind, the description is difficult. It's almost like, what's the difference between one species and another? When we're talking about vineyards, we're talking about grapevines, and a grapevine is a grapevine. But I guess if you looked at apples, not all apples come from the same variety of apple. You have a number of different apples, and that some are different colours and some are different flavours. Well, here in this business, we can actually have a variety, say, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, and we can have it in different apple flavours, in a sense. And that's the difference between clones. They're different selections of the same variety, and therefore they'll bring unique qualities with them. And those qualities could be time of ripening. They could be density of structure. They could be vibrance of fruit. And there could be all these variables, but that's the difference between clones, I guess, is they have a unique quality between each other.
Steve Johnson of Parallel 44, my wife and I are owners here of our vineyard that we established in 2005. The word I would like to describe would be fruit forward. It's a word that we typically use in our winery. It's a more commonly used term these days also, but I think there's some misconception about what fruit forward means. Sometimes I think people say it's synonymous with sweetness. But for us, we've really found that the varietals that we grow here in the upper Midwest have a very fruit-forward component. That is sort of the beginning of your expression on your palate. It sort of really pops, and it's due to two things, I think. One, the varietals that we have, like Frontenac, Fourche, Frontenac Gris, have that innate in the chemistry of the grape. But secondarily, this cooler climate we have, the aromatics of the wine seem to be captured in the grape. They don't burn off in the heat of a longer or hotter climate. And so we want people to really taste the fruit of the grape, and we have the benefit from our varietals and our climate that allows that to be expressed on your palate. And it's not necessarily the residual sugar in the wine that you're tasting, it's actually the flavor of the grape. Particularly important here in our neck of the woods, where there are actually a lot of fruit wines being made, and people need to make sure that when we say fruit forward, they're not thinking, oh, you put raspberries and strawberries in your wine. No, that's just the inherent flavor expression of the grapes we grow here.
I am Marcus Goodfellow of Metello Wines, a small winery in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And my idea of dry farming is a vineyard, one that's not irrigated, and the point behind that simply being that when you introduce water into the plant, you change the dynamic of that plant's need for one of the formative aspects of its growth. You stop the plant from sending the roots deeper. You allow the plant to maintain moisture at a period when it normally wouldn't, so the plant doesn't create defenses. Every animal and every plant being whatever mutates and adapts to its particular situation. And if you leave it to adapt to its particular situation. It will create something that is unique in its own makeup and matter, which then will be reflected in the wine. And when you irrigate, you cheat the plant and the wine out of that individual nature.
I'm Paul Leary from Blackbird Vineyards in Napa Valley, California, and my word is Merlot. How do I think about Merlot? Merlot is when we first started Blackbird. The first vintage of the wine was 96 Merlot, 96%. The second vintage, I think, was 95%. Merlot to us, what people forget is that Merlot is one of the most noble varietals in the world. And noble is a technical term there within the wine industry. The most expensive wine at release every year generally is a Merlot, Chateau Petrus. Merlot gives you great density and plushness and roundness. It's a little bit more approachable in its youth than its brother, Cabernet Sauvignon. To us, it's a wine that, because it's a very high-producing or high-yield wine, if it's grown in the right restrictive environment, can yield absolutely amazing character. We focus on Merlot because it's not as common in the Napa Valley. You know, what's interesting is it's not Merlot, it's Merlot, by the way. If you look up the pronunciation. And you can see when I say that, sometimes people kind of look at you. I'm like, no, that's actually how you say it. So there's a tidbit right there. There are so many great left bank wines in the United States, in California, in the Napa Valley. We wanted to focus on the right bank, and Merlot is the queen there. Our winemaker, Aaron Pott, lives by Merlot, besides all the other varietals he makes. So, for us, the name Blackbird, the name Merlot, they mean something to one another. Merlot translates as little blackbird. So when we think about the Merlot wines that we produce, they're wines that, like I say, although they have approachability in their youth, they have true ageability. You know, we produce wines that have, 25 plus years. And people don't think about that. They forget about that, of what the varietal can be. And so for us, it's something that we have, true respect for and look forward to being able to share with others.
Scott Lloyd, Frank Family Vineyards. The word is brand loyalty. To me, it's defined as continuing to support that product because you know year after year it's going to continue to deliver for you. To me, it's important to have that consistency. Maybe not a Wikipedia definition, but to me, that's kind of what it is.
Hi, this is Brooks Painter, Director of Winemaking at Castella di Amorosa, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the term Surlis or Lees. This is sometimes not a well-known concept. Lees refers to the solids at the bottom of a tank or a barrel. Surlis is the French phrase for meaning aging the wine on those solids and on those lees. Generally, as I said, it's composed of dead yeast cells, and as the wine remains in contact for a period of time on the lees, and I'm thinking of Chardonnay, for example, is a very standard protocol in Chardonnay production. Those yeast cells, as they age and start to decompose, they actually release various compounds into the wine, specifically some things called mannoproteins, and this will change the texture and the mouthfeel of the wine. It will add more volume. When you're aging Surlis, you will often go back and stir the lees, and again, borrowing a word from France, batonnage, you use your baton to stick into the barrel and swirl up the lees and mix it up. And this does a couple of things, including the enrichment of the wine that I just referred to with mannoproteins, but it will also protect from oxidation because the lees are considered a sink for oxygen, and it actually will inhibit oxidation of the wine by leaving the wine in contact with the lees. And there's a number of other interesting things that occur during that aging process, but Surlis on the lees.
I'm Steve Fennell, the winemaker and general manager for Sanford, and my word is vinifera, species Vitis vinifera. And it's really what is known as the European both wine grapes and table grapes, actually. So certainly if you think of anything planted in Europe or California, Oregon, Washington, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all of those grapes are vinifera.
Jeff Meyer from J. Lohr Vineyards and Wines. An appellation is an area of similar soils, similar climatic conditions, and similar overall growing environment. An appellation can be from a few acres to several hundred acres to 1,000 acres. That can be within a county, can be within a larger appellation. If you think of the Napa Valley, there are many sub-appellations or smaller appellations like Stag's Leap or the Rutherford Bench area. And it really just sort of helps the consumer or the producer define what wine styles would come from a particular area.
My name is Craig Hazaro. I'm the proprietor with Sojourn Cellars, and I'm going to talk about native fermentations. So in the winemaking process, we are effectively taking grapes that are about 25% sugar, and we are going to take those grapes and make them 0% sugar. And in the process of the fermentation, the alcohol, sugar is going to get converted to alcohol, and the alcohol is going to go from about 0 to about 14%. There's a couple of different ways and a couple of different tools that winemakers have to achieve that process. It's important, every winemaker uses yeast, and there's a couple of different ways to do this. Way number one, the more traditional method, is to simply go buy yeast and to use a traditional yeast, add it into the process to start the fermentation. And the reason why winemakers like to add yeast and add a packaged yeast is because the packaged yeast adds a lot of control into the process. These yeasts have been formulated over years. They know how they're going to act. They know what kind of aromatics they're going to end up with on the backside. And it is a very predictable style of creating a fermentation. On the other hand, a native fermentation is created by simply using the yeast that's available, you know, on the skins of the grapes, on the walls of the winery, on the barrels, on the floors, on the equipment, etc., and effectively just allowing the grapes to naturally warm up as they naturally warm up into the 60s and 70s, and to allow a spontaneous fermentation to start and to go through a fermentation process like that. It's risky, you don't have the control, but most winemakers agree, although not everyone's willing to take the risk, that there are significant benefits on the backside, especially in the area of aromatics. And that's why Sojourn has decided to do all of our fermentations as native only, and we're willing to take that risk.
Thanks for listening, and watch for our next program. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Steve Lance. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2013.